The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Welcome to Film Weekly, I'm Jason Solomons. On the show this week, I meet Swedish actress Noomi Rapace, the original Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, now finding fortune as a gypsy in Guy Ritchie's Sherlock Holmes. And from one Holmes to another, Benedict Cumberbatch, who plays Sherlock in the BBC TV series, is the star of Wreckers, a small-scale brooding drama telling of fraught family relations in rural England. I'll be meeting its director, D.R. Hood, to find out more, including what the rest of the letters in her name are. Sam Brooks will be along to review some of the week's big releases, including Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows, Carol Morley's documentary Dreams of a Life, and Christmas classic Meet Me in St. Louis gets a big screen re-release. It's the Christmas party everyone's invited to. It's Film Weekly. Now, if you told me just a few years ago that a fairly obscure Swedish journalist would create a series of novels that would push Swedish crime writing onto the bestseller lists and spawn not just one series of films, but also take an unknown actress called Noomi Rapace and make her a Hollywood star, well, I would have asked you, Är du galen? Which is Swedish for are you mad? But you're not, and neither, certainly, is Noomi Rapace, as this week, just as the Hollywood remake of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo opens in America, she rather smartly opens herself alongside Jude Law and Robert Downey Jr. in Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows. This is, of course, the second instalment of Guy Ritchie's reboot of the ever-bankable creation of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and I met up with Noomi Rapace and began by asking her if her fairly meteoric rise had caught her off guard. But before we hear from her, let's hear her in action as fortune-teller Madame Zimzer opposite Holmes and Watson.
Who are you two?
Concerned citizens.
Why did someone try to kill me?
Your brother has become involved with a very dangerous man who clearly believes that René has told you something you shouldn't know.
I don't know anything. I've been looking for him for over a year. That was why I was in London. It's the last place anyone saw him.
It's clear that your brother loves you, so he would never send you a message that would put you in harm's way. Any information, therefore, would be by default unintentional.
Has he sent you anything else?
Just a few drawings.
This journey has been quite surreal, and I'm still a bit in shock. You know, I'm doing, you know, I just finished a move with Ridley Scott, one of my, you know, greatest, biggest heroes. And you know, I've been working with Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law and Guy Ritchie. And so I'm quite, I don't know, you know, it's fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, Lisbeth Salander, in the three films that you did, you know, she was started out as a mystery woman, and then we found out more and more about her.
Yeah.
That was always going to be, you know, that was always going to be something that was interesting for you, to start out mysterious and then reveal more of yourself as an actress. Is that something you planned for the three films?
Yeah, I actually had a big fight with the director on the first one, because there was a scene in the end of the first one when Lisbeth told Michael her whole life story, everything, you know, from her childhood and her father and, you know, everything. And I was like, when I came to that, when I read the script, I was like, you're kidding me. You know, this is not her. She would never do that. She doesn't talk about herself. She would never, never, ever say anything on this. You know, he's like, I'm not doing it. And he was like, you need to do it, because some people haven't read the books and some people would not see the second and third one. They need to know. They want to know why she's such a freak and why she's so dark and complicated. I was like, I'm sorry, I'm not going to do it. And we had a big fight, and it ended up him, you know, he was like, we don't have a movie if you don't do this scene. And I was like, okay, call the producers, tell them I'm not doing the movie. I'm not doing that scene, so we don't have a movie. It was quite intense, but we had already started, you know, so he couldn't fire me because we had been working for a couple of months. So, and then he came back to me like a couple of weeks later, and he said, okay, what if we do it this way? What if Michael talks instead? And then we kind of worked together and we found a scene. We kind of wrote a scene together when they talk about responsibility and, you know, moral and things like that. And in the end of the scene, Michael says, you know, you don't need to tell me. I don't need to know. I've realized that you've gone through, you know, tough things, and I'm just grateful that you're here, something like that. And then she says, thank you. And that's the big change in her, because she've never said thank you ever, you know, before. So we were working. I felt like she was living in me, and I kind of knew who, I felt like I knew who she was.
So who's the person that did all the fighting? Is that Noomi Rapace, or is that Lisbeth Salander? Which, do you know what I mean? Is it you, or just because you've been playing Lisbeth, you've decided to get, you could get really feisty and spiky?
You know what? I started to prep. I was prepping for 7 months, and I really felt like I woke up some kind of demon in me. I was doing this kickboxing and Thai boxing, 5 days a week for 7 months. And I took the license for motorcycle, and I did all those piercings, and we cut my hair. And it was like she was growing in me, and she came to me, you know, slowly. And then, and I kind of felt after a while like, wow, I actually enjoy fighting. And I like taking a couple of punches and, you know, punch back. And it's quite interesting how you can embrace things when you're prepping for a role, and how you can feel like you're changing and transforming into another person. Yeah. So when we did the fight scenes, I always try to do my own stunts, and as much as they allow me. And I want to do it, because you can always tell if it's a stunt woman coming in and doing fantastic things, and it doesn't really make sense, you know, because I want it to be real. So it was Noomi, probably, but a version of me, Noomi Lisbeth.
So what are you like now? When, you know, now, I mean, Guy Ritchie, Jude Law, Robert Downey Jr., that's quite a kind of a macho set. There's kind of a lot of fighting going on in that, with Holmes and Watson. Mm-hmm. There's like, and your character in the kind of the gypsy area, there's fighting, and there's, were you that, who were you this time? Were you, obviously you're an actress, so you get into the character, but did you bring a kind of independence to that too?
I Guy Ritchie gave me a lot of freedom to find Zimza and to create her, and to build her. And she's a very street smart girl. She's very, she's used to take care of herself. She's quite rough, you know, and I like that. She, you know, she's quite rebellious. Many gypsies, you know, they marry really young, and they, you know, build families really young. And she, you know, she's kind of living outside that a bit, and she's going her own way. And she was a part of an anarchist group in Paris for a while, and she wanted to change, you know, the situation for gypsies. And then
there's a bit of Lisbeth in that, in that anarchism, in that kind of blowing stuff
and
up.
She doesn't accept, you know, authorities, and she, you know, she's living outside the society. She's also quite lonely and an outsider, and sort of an outlaw, you know. But she's much more woman, you know. She likes being a woman, and she's more, you know, she's more playing on that. And she's more of a team player. Mm. You know, she likes to be in a team, and she likes to work together with, you know, Watson and Holmes. And, you know, when they go on this journey through Europe, it's like she's very loyal, and she would die for them if necessary.
Did you do, you talked about some gypsy there, that gypsy women often marry young. Did you do some research into gypsy communities as well?
Yeah, I wanted to go and live with gypsies. I had this big, long list of things I wanted to do, but I didn't have time.
What else was on the list? Do you want to live with gypsies?
Yes, I wanted to learn how to dance, the old gypsy dances, and to sing, and to, you know, I wanted to learn the old gypsy language, Romani. So there was many things that I wanted to do, and I kind of, you know, I was prepping for 3 weeks, so it was super intense.
That's a busy 3 weeks. You're gonna do all that?
No, so I couldn't do everything. But I you know, this came, a woman came to London called Sita, and she was, you know, she stayed with me, and she helped me. She taught me how to dance and to sing, and also I was interviewing her, you know, about how gypsies lived and the difference, you know, today and how it was back then.
And did you, you had that, obviously there was a respect for the part that you wanted to get right. Did you learn that, I mean, often when I talk to actors, they always say, well, we're gypsies as well, you know, we're kind of travellers in a trunk, we're kind of from here to there, we're back from London to Sweden to America, and this, that kind of life is something that an actor can really kind of understand.
Yeah, I think so. It's definitely, I can feel a bit like, you know, that I have a gypsy lifestyle, but I'm spoiled, you know. I have money, and I have people supporting me, taking care of me. So it's a bit, you know, actors are, it's not the same thing, because gypsies have a quite hard situation today and back then. And, you know, even today, it's kind of shocked me to realize how bad they are treated in, you know, France and in Italy, in Sweden, you know, in Spain, in many countries, and in East Europe, they are, in some countries, you know, they treat them worse than animals. And that was quite shocking to realize. Mm-hmm. So even if we can say in a romantic way that we have a gypsy lifestyle, it's not really the same. But I think it's some kind of spirit of moving on and always kind of being on the move and leaving places and coming to new places. Yeah. And I feel like, yeah, I've been on this hotel for, I don't know, maybe almost a week. And this is my home now. And I was in LA before that. And then I'm used to kind of leave things and move on. And yeah. I'm not so sentimental.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Gypsies and Claridges. We don't.
Haven't seen one yet, but maybe we will.
I saw Gordon Ramsay downstairs in the cooking, but it's not the same.
Not really.
We mentioned Dragon Tattoo earlier. And obviously, Dragon Tattoo is out again. You know, that the kind of legacy that you leave. Does it feel strange to you? I mean, obviously, you knew ages ago that you wouldn't be in the new David Fincher version of Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Is it strange to see somebody else now doing your Lisbeth?
No, not really. You know, she really lived in me for 1.5 years, and she was in control pretty much. And I was on the edge when we wrapped. I was, I was definitely done with her, and it was good to let her go. Mm-hmm. And so, for me, it doesn't feel, because I left her that day, and it doesn't feel like they've taken, my character. So I feel quite curious to see what they do. And I really respect David Fincher. I think he's amazing. So they would probably do something that is really specific and personal for them and different from what we did.
A huge tack, thank you, to Noomi Rapace. And Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows, is on general release in the UK from Friday, the 16th of December. And from a girl with a dragon tattoo to a boy with an I Love Mum tattoo on his shoulder, Zan Brooks joins me. It's that time of the week where we get together to be the Watson and Holmes of film criticism. So, Zan, we'll start with Sherlock, but we'll also look at Carol Morley's Dreams of a Life, which we featured on the show last week with director Carol Morley and star Zoe Ashton. And then we'll talk about the reissue of a Christmas classic, Meet Me in St. Louis. Louis? One of those. We'll decide what are we going to call it by the end. But let's kick off with someone who gave it a 4-star review, Zan. Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows.
Yeah, do you see that as a dereliction of duty, 4 stars? I was surprised by this. I went in thinking this is going to be junk. And I came out thinking, that's junk, but, what good quality junk.
Yeah, I was surprised by your 4 stars, I have to say.
would you have given it?
Even a short 1.
Really?
I hated it. I've got to say, I really hated it. I mean, I knew Mira Passo, I went to interview, because I thought she was the sort of least affected thing in it, although she was terribly underused. She was useless in it, really. I mean, I don't know what the point of her doing in it at all. She clearly did a lot of work and homework for it, but I mean, completely wasted that. Kind of that's why I hated it. I just didn't think that anything made any sense. It wasn't funny. Almost from the word go, I was like, oh, God, I hate this. My hairs were on the back of my neck. But a lot of other people do think it's fun. I mean, you're not just being mad.
I'm not entirely alone, but I think I'm certainly in the minority. It doesn't seem to be getting that good a response. I thought that it was shameful escapism. I thought it was borderline irresponsible. There's been a lot of debate about how close it is to Sherlock Holmes, because apparently he was really good at fighting and he did jump around a lot and all that sort of true. But really, it's not Holmes as Arthur Conan Doyle.
Isn't Holmes that I used to read and watch? We used to be about solving a mystery and you kind of think, right,
as opposed
that
to beating up brigands and
this
leaping
film
around.
Has no interest
not at
in
all.
Plot or a mystery.
Not at all.
There isn't even a mystery going on.
No, there's
on.
Not. There's virtually no plot.
Yeah.
It is just the exploding train and then the fight with the Cossack around the terrace of the casino. And yet I really went along with it and I really enjoyed it. And I remember you were saying a similar thing about that Three Musketeers film that came out a little while ago, that there was just something utterly unpretentious and flyweight about it. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I like Robert Downey Jr. as Holmes.
You see, I normally love the Robert Downey
Jr.
Yeah,
well, I thought he's good as Holmes.
I couldn't understand a word he was saying.
And I was a big fan of Jared Harris as Moriarty.
Yeah,
I thought that Jared Harris was great in this.
That was really good.
It's a proper good meaty villain's role.
Yeah.
He's got he's the sort of dusty academic, but it's a facade, and there's the evil genius behind that, and he's got the unblinking stare and the little teeth glittering through his beard, and it's a really good comic book villain performance.
Yeah, and I like the fact that they presage it with just his voice, and it's quite a familiar voice. Now, it's got that tinge of his dad's voice, but it's also quite known from Mad Men, etc.
Yeah.
And I like that you could hear his voice, and I was like, I think they've got Jared Harris in Moriarty.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really good to see him. And yet, he still didn't do anything.
Oh, he does everything. Yeah, he's pulling all the strings. Genius. He's playing chess at the end, isn't he?
I mean, isn't he? It's his World War One is started because of Moriarty, or something.
Well,
that seems to be the plot.
Well, this is 1891, so he's running a little ahead of schedule, isn't he? But he's got a plan to hatch World War One and then trade arms to the highest dealer.
Yeah.
I am no fan of Guy Ritchie as a director, but I think that he has found his the right template for him with these films. That these old school public school adventures, which gives him the license to, you know, run wild with the gypsies and eat hedgehog goulash and get into fights with brigands in dark alleyways. And all of it is thoroughly irresponsible and probably borderline reprehensible. And yet, maybe just at the end of a long, hard year, this is exactly the
but
tonic.
But wasn't it about... I mean, it starts with a little gun and then someone shoots a little sort of derringer. And then the guns just each scene just get bigger, bigger and bigger and bigger until it's the biggest gun in the world.
Yeah, that Watson lets off, doesn't he?
And then someone even lets a bit... I think even at the end, when they run away, there's an even bigger gun. Is it a howitzer? Is it a munitions factory? It is an ode to bigger guns.
It's an ode to bigger guns, and it's an ode to male love, I think.
Yeah.
There's a definite homoerotic vibe going on here between Holmes and Watson. Watson is supposed to be getting married, but of course Holmes keeps kind of spiriting him away from the honeymoon and saying, aren't you having so much more fun with me?
Yeah,
so,
and then he gets a
I'm not even sure that this is intentional from Guy Ritchie.
He's in a dress half the time.
Yeah, there's a hilarious bit where Holmes dresses up like Rupert Everett in St. Trinian's. To rescue Watson from the train. And then, of course, Moriarty sidles in, and that's the love rival. And so it's a three triangle.
Yeah,
is that triangle.
What this is about? Because all the women end up really... I mean, Kelly Riley, who I love, she's got sort of no parts.
No, there's no parts for women.
And Rachel McAdams turns up right at the beginning for no reason at all other than that she was in the first one. And then poor old Noomi Rapace. I don't know what she's doing.
No interest in women, because it's not a world for women.
It isn't, is it?
It's Bullingdon.
They shouldn't get... Yeah, it is the Bullingdon Club. I found it... utterly irritating. I mean, really.
And I should have done, and I'm not sure I'd ever watch it again.
No, you should defend yourself.
But I really enjoyed it.
Quite right. It wasn't funny. It didn't make
it's not especially funny.
But in the Bond way, that Bond could be funny. You know, there was obviously, there's Bourne and Bond in here as well, where the shooting and they lie there. And Robert Downey Jr. should be really good at that. I think he'd make a great James Bond. And somehow it's all that banter is not working.
No, he wouldn't. No, he wouldn't make a good James Bond because he doesn't actually look tough. He would make a good Flashman, maybe. Yeah. And that's the other kind of reference I detected from time to time in this.
Yeah, I get your schoolboy out. I mean, actually, Jude Law, I thought, was all right in this.
Yeah,
I think
he's found
his stride as Watson. Yeah. It's a little limp, but nevertheless, he's found it. That is Sherlock Holmes at Game of Shadows. And I suppose take it or leave it, really.
I think take it.
Marmite. But, I mean, lots of people do like it. So I might be just alone. It just wasn't what I wanted to see. So I should have known that when I went in to see something called Sherlock Holmes, Game of Shadows. I should have known what I was going to see. Carol Morley's Dreams of a Life, Zan. We shall move on. I had them on the show last week, and I was very proud to do so, because this is a film that has stayed with me since I've seen it, and I've seen it again since it played at the London Film Festival. Dreams of a Life is about a woman who was found in a flat 3 years after she died in 2006 in North London, and she's resurrected by Carol Morley's film starring Zoe Ashton.
I worked at the paper for 10 years and there wasn't a story like it. There was such a remarkable lack of information about Joyce Vincent, it was so hard to find anything about her. It always struck me as strange how there's just swarms of thousands of people going around the business, getting the shopping, meeting the friends, and all this time there was a woman in the flats above and nobody knew that she was there.
Now, I discussed this with Karen and Zari last week. Is it a documentary? Is it a drama? Is it a docudrama? What is it? Karen Morley sort of says it's sort of just a film, really. And I don't quite know where to put this one. It reminded me very much of The Arbor, which was one of my favourite films of last year.
Yeah.
How has this one gone down with you?
Well, I think that's true. It's unclassifiable. And that's a pro and a con, I think. But really more a pro. I think that this is a fascinating film about Joyce Vincent, who was found dead in her flat in Wood Green.
Shopping
she was
City.
38 years old, not, you know, conforming to the typical image of the hermit who can die without anybody noticing at all, in that she was, young, attractive, reasonably successful, reasonably sociable. She had family, she had friends, she had Christmas presents surrounding her when she died.
She was watching BBC One.
Watching BBC One, and the TV stayed on for 3 years. Yeah. So it's a story.
That's why I don't watch the One Show. It could just happen to me.
And it could happen to you, and then you'd be trapped there.
And Clarkson will be on being rude. It might even wake me up.
Well, that just could be the last thing you heard.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my God.
And because it's somebody like her, I guess the implication is it could be something like us and that we're all just a shuffle step away from, you know, the implication here is that London is this vast, big, uncaring city and it's the lonely crowd and we're all just a slight step away from slipping off the A to Z altogether.
Or down the back
and
of the
being,
sofa.
Yeah, and being gone. And that is scary.
Mm.
So it's a film that does raise a lot of issues. I had a lot of problems with the film. I thought that the use of dramatic reconstructions occasionally is jarring, but I think possibly necessary to fill out the gaps. And it is a totally by its nature a film.
See,
about
I
gaps.
Like the jarringness of the.
There is a lot of jarring.
They brought me out of the kind of usual talking headness, the usual documentary, into actually sort of appreciating this person's life a
yes,
little bit
Yes, I think you do need them because it's all lacuna, this film. And you had family members who declined to be interviewed for this. So you're relying on a sort of thin spread of the people who would collaborate, including Martin, the ex-boyfriend, who breaks down in a very kind of moving scene. That's
Isn't it wonderful?
The key scene of the film.
I mean, he broke my heart, really. Yeah. For me, this is, you know, certainly, I mean, we don't want to give anything away in our films of the year coming up soon, but this is kind of going higher and higher up my list each time I see it and think about it and talk about it.
I think it has been, you know, I think we probably say this every year, it has been another very good year for documentaries, and this is one of the five or six great ones of the year.
That's Carol Morley's Dreams of a Life. Now, it wouldn't be Christmas without a few reissues back in the cinema to give us a festive flavour. One of them's Judy Garland.
Judy, you bad girl, you should be asleep.
Did he come yet? I've been waiting such a long time, and I haven't seen a thing.
Did who come?
Santa Claus.
Now, you know he's not going to come until you're asleep.
How will he know how to find us next year? He's so used to coming here.
Oh, you can't fool him. He can find anybody he wants to find.
Meet me in St. Louis. Zan, or would you meet me in St. Louis?
Well, I'm going the European way, so I'll call it Meet Me in St. Louis.
Yeah.
But doesn't it even depend in America which side of the river you're on?
Yeah, I had this debate with the guy about the film. There was a silent film about Louis Armstrong, who I always call Louis Armstrong, but you're supposed to call him Louis Armstrong.
Yeah.
But the film was called Louis. And then you just think of John Lewis here. It confuses me. But I think it is Meet Me in St. Louis, officially.
Okay, well, let's stick with that. And it's... Is it Vincent Minnelli?
It is. Vincenti.
Vincente. It's Vincente Minnelli. It's Judy Garland, which doesn't leave much room for Manila there.
Quite
not. As the eldest daughter of the Smiths, who are a middle-class family in St. Louis. And it's a great, broad, romantic hymn, I guess, to the Midwestern way of life.
Because Dad
at the turn of the 20th
them,
century.
Dad wants to take them
Dad
away.
Dad wants to take them away, away. Yes. So you know, it's like Thornton Wilder's Our Town. It's you know, the ties that bind. It's the little rituals of life. It's flirting with the next door neighbor. It's the great warmth of, you know, large town America.
It is a musical.
And it's about how these things are sort of fragile and precious and can be uprooted.
Yeah, I suppose so. All of that was that. I've just found this. I mean, I love a musical. Don't get me wrong. I'm going to confess right now. I love it. This is really one of my least favorite musicals.
Why?
I think she looks like a troll in it, Judy Garland. If I'm honest, I couldn't bear watching her. I know she belts out the "Have Yourself a Merry
Yeah, she does.
Christmas,
and the trolley song.
And the trolley song, bang, bang. And I like the trolley song, you know. But I just think she looks like a gargoyle.
And that ruins the whole film for
you? Yeah, I mean, yeah, it really does.
Okay.
Because
she's in it a lot, isn't
she's
she?
It's almost every frame. I mean, she's kind of, I mean, there's her, the sisters and the family.
Yeah, there's Margaret O'Brien.
Yeah, Margaret O'Brien. I don't like the colours in it. I didn't find it witty.
Really, I like the colours in it. I mean, it's Technicolour, so I was imagining great splashes of primary colours.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of it's quite sombre.
Indeed.
They look like kind of old masters, really.
Yeah.
There's a sort of depth and a richness to every frame that I actually liked a great deal. I don't like musicals. My prejudice is that I tend...
It's because you're so macho. It's,
it's
like
because
that
I'm
Guy
really
Ritchie
macho
movie.
Because I've got the tattoos,
yeah.
You see. I'm aware that it's totally my failing, but film is always about an imaginative leap, and I can't make that leap into the musical because I always think, why are you suddenly singing? Where's the band?
Yeah.
And I've never been able to quite take it on trust.
It's like that bit in Blazing Saddles where he's playing like along that. And then there's the Count Basie orchestra just
it knocks me out of the film. I think this isn't real.
That fourth wall thing, you've not got it. I don't know how you dealt with the Carol Morley's
Dreams
of a Life.
I'm a very limited man. And yet, Meet Me Instantly is one of the few musicals that I'd make an exception for.
Right, well you would, and I don't want to see it again.
Okay,
clearly.
Well then don't.
But I do like Minnelli in general. I think he's, you know, kind of a bit of a master at this sort of thing. Meet Me Mr. Lewis, Judy Garland back on your big screen in time for Christmas. Zan, thank you very much for joining me. We will be talking about our end of year films very soon. So keep
your
list close to your
chest. Have you done your list?
I have done my list. I've been a good boy and got my homework in. I found it, I mean, I don't want to press it. I found it really hard this year. I thought, is it a good
difficult
year film? I don't know. I could, there were almost sort of 25 films that I could have made, or each
me
the number
too.
One.
Me too, which I guess suggests that it has been a vintage year.
Yeah, very, very strong indeed. We shall talk about that when we resume. But for now, for all of Zan's reviews and so much more, go to the best film site on the web, guardian.co.uk/film. This week throws up another classic example of the breadth of British cinema. On the one hand, we've got the blockbuster Sherlock, and on the other, we've got a brooding, small-scale drama that needs no CGI or major studio help. Wreckers is the debut feature by director D.R. Hood, featuring rising talents Benedict Cumberbatch and Claire Foy. The film is a tense young family drama and packs a lot of punch, so I'm delighted to have with me in the studio the director of Wreckers, D.R. Hood, or Dictinor Hood, is that correct?
Yes, that's Dictinor. Very correct.
Good. Yeah. I thought when I first saw the film that it was directed by Dr. Hood.
Yeah, I quite like that actually.
Which is very cool.
It's D. Dictinor and my second name Ruth, but I quite like that people mistake it for Dr. Hood.
Yeah, he sounds like either a mysterious villain or someone from the Louisiana Bayou.
Yeah,
but anyway, exactly. You're not from there at all. Is this your debut feature?
Yeah, that's
pitch it to me. Tell me what Wreckers is about.
It's about a young couple who played by Claire Foy and Benedict Cumberbatch, and they move back to his childhood home, this village, and they've just got married, and it all seems very, very, very idyllic. And then into the picture comes his brother, who's played by Sean Evans, who's a soldier on leave, and very slowly you begin to realise that the marriage is not quite as you imagined, and that David, the husband, may have secrets that he's hiding from.
And funny enough, I'm terrible in the countryside. I don't, you know, the moths and the bugs and all of that stuff. And, you know, and I've seen straw dogs as well. You shouldn't go to the countryside. It's dangerous.
Yes.
I really felt that I knew your countryside, that kind of the kind of overgrown weeds of it, the kind of rotting farm machinery, and yet also people kind of there was an ease, you know, that kind of it felt very the atmosphere was beautifully captured. Your camera woman Anne Marie,
yes, had
a wonderful job of atmosphere in it, which made me feel that it was a very sort of French film. I feel films about the French countryside, it felt like that.
But I have been told it's like a French film, but I don't know.
It is, in a good way. I mean, the eminent French critic Michel Simon was over here at the London Film Festival, and he'd seen your film, and he said to me, I've seen the British movie this morning, very good. It is Wreckers. It is really quite good. No, really. So there you go. I mean, and he doesn't give away his really goods very lightly.
Good. So, well, I'm very glad because he's our first French audience member, as far as I'm aware.
I mean, it'd be nice if the British audience responded to it, but it is hard for a little film like yours to find a British audience, don't you think? I mean, brilliantly, you've been picked up by Artificial Eye, so you're getting distribution. Was that something you had in place earlier? Did you know where your film would end up?
No, we didn't. We made it independently, and we were actually in touch with BBC Acquisitions all the way through, just with emails back and forth and contact there. And we did let a number of distributors know about it about a year before we finished it. But very happily, our actors got more and more famous while we were editing the film, which definitely helped.
Yes, because when we talk about Benedict Cumberbatch and Claire Foy and Sean Evans, indeed. But I mean, Benedict in particular is now sort of gone stellar from Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and he's in War Horse now. And so when you were working with with him. Did you know he was doing all of those things? Was he a hot young actor then?
No, I mean, we felt very pleased to cast those three. We knew they were great and we thought they were fantastic actors, and they were, you know, hard for us to get, but they weren't in the space that they are now, particularly Benedict, and well, all of them.
Yeah.
None of them were quite in the space they are now.
I mean, I love Claire Foy in the Dickens adaptation of Little Dorrit.
Yes.
She was brilliant in that, I think. And that's where I saw. But I mean, this was one of the first sort of films I think I've seen her really working, and it was really good to see her have being stretched, I think.
Yes.
In this.
I think she is stretched, and I think it's a very interesting role for her because it's a little bit older, and it's a real film role in a way, isn't it? Because she doesn't do so much talking. She does a lot of watching and just sort of being there, and she's absolutely fantastic in it.
Yeah, where did you shoot it? Which rural village is this place? We probably won't want to own up to it, will it?
I've actually been back to show it to the village en masse, which was brilliant. I really enjoyed that.
Where did you show it? In the church hall?
It's in the Fens. No, I showed it in a village hall.
Yeah.
A modern village hall.
Okay.
With very bad acoustics, actually. But apart from that, it was very interesting showing it to the people from that village.
In the Fens, you say?
In the Fens. Yeah. It was. It's east of Cambridge, right on the edge of the Fens. And people were very, very kind to us filming. A lot of the reactions to the film when I took it back there were to do with the fact that a lot of the extras had been cut, which was not to do with their performances, but it was more to do with the fact that we just needed to keep it very close to the five main characters. But the animals had all survived, and so there was an element of bitterness about the animals surviving the extras being cut.
My rabbit is brilliant in the film, and they're going to be asking for money now.
Well, there's a whole row of dog fanciers when we went to show it. So I really, it needed to be done. It was quite important for me to go and show it to the people who helped us make
absolutely.
It.
No,
and I'd love to film there again because I feel we didn't even get started with that landscape.
I mean, all these things are important. The church plays an important part of it. It really captured a sort of rhythm of life that I like very much. But as you say, it's very intensely done, the drama between all of these people. It could have been urban, but I think the fact that the rural setting, it gives it a bit of room and it kind of informs the drama in some way. That the symbolism of creeping weeds, I suppose, in some kind of way, is where this family have got to, and they can cover many ills and multitudes of cracks, I suppose.
Yes, it did do something for it. I mean, my producer and I did discuss moving it into the town for kind of ease, but we agreed that it should be kept outdoors. The house was actually shot on the edge of London, so a huge part of the film was shot in London, actually. Mm. But it sort of seamlessly meshes with the creeping weeds. Yes.
Well, it's a very intense film, very well performed as well, and I thought that the atmosphere was excellent. You mentioned that rural England, and it's funny that Andrea Arnold has just done her Wuthering Heights, which is, you know, full of wind and countryside, of which there's another film that was at the LFF at the same time as yours called Straw Fields, about hop picking in strawberry picking in Kent. I think there is a sudden movement back to that kind of that the response to rural England in cinema. There is a kind of realistic kind of push there now. I think I'm sort of sensing a movement now. In fact, with those three films, yours, Strawberry Fields, and Andrea Arnold's Wuthering Heights, there's a feature now. It's true. The countryside is biting back on the big screen.
Well, you may well be right. I haven't seen either of those films, but I would like to. And I would like to think, yes, I think there's a lot more to be said about rural England.
Yeah, I think we got obsessed with kind of, you know, urban dramas and you know, Hackney, everyone filming in Hackney. You know,
yes.
And then we can go around the country and everything.
Yeah, no, there's a lot going on now in the country, I can tell you.
Well, Dixon, Wreckers is a really, really strong debut. I hope will it be leading to something else? Have you got anything else lined up now?
Hopefully on a romantic comedy next.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Oh, I like a laugh. Anyway, it's not about dresses, though, is it?
No, it's not about dresses.
Good.
It hasn't got creeping weeds, but it's still got quite a lot of drunken mess in it.
Good. That sounds good already. I'm looking forward to it. Well, congratulations on your day. We look forward to the follow-up. And please come back on Film Weekly and talk to us about that one then.
Thanks very much indeed, Jason. Thank you.
And Dick Dinahood's Wreckers is on release, limited release, but seek it out from this Friday, the 16th of December. That's all we have for this week. We'll be doing our top 10 of 2011 next week, and we want your contributions. Send us your top 3 films of 2011. Just email us film.weekly@guardian.co.uk, and there's a chance for you to win a year's membership to a Picture House cinema near you. What a prize! It's just a UK competition, I'm afraid, because Picture House aren't international yet. I know you listen out there around the world, but you can't enter this one unless you're in the UK. Well, you can enter. We want to know your top 3. But you can't win a Picture House cinema membership. But it's a brilliant prize. Email us your top 3s anyway, and your name is in the hat. film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. Put top 3 in the subject line, and we'll read the best out as me and Sam run down our top 10 in that show. The music we've been featuring on the show this week is from Sherlock Holmes' score by the master himself, Hans Zimmer. Is there anything he can't do? But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.